good guys.
Exactly, he says. The couple gets here and the girl is like, I hate clowns. And the doofus boyfriend is like, I do too. And they complain. And then eventually they get a machine gun and just spray the clowns.
40, I snap. Did you look to see if they have rooms? He ignores me.
You know, he says, last time I was here, it was with Love and Michael.
I feign surprise as if I didn't already know this, as if we aren't here because I know this. Love posted a hashtag Throwback Thursday photo a few months ago, harkening back to another era, when she did drugs and had a tongue piercing and eyeliner below her eyes, not above. The three of them came here on the way to Burning Man. God, am I glad I didn't know her then. The comments told a story. Love and 40 and Michael Motorcycle traveled here, lured in by the gigantic clown boards promising free Wi-Fi and welcome bikers. 40 disappeared with the car. He showed up a month later. He didn't apologize. In minutes, we are there. I pull into the parking lot and drive around the back, the part of this tourist trap that I wanted to see the most, the early American cemetery.
Do you know what a travesty it is that we have no shrooms? 40 asks. You can't be in this cemetery without shrooms.
Fuck yes, I lie. I park in the farthest corner. I don't see any cameras, but the mug of piss I left in Rhode Island is with me at times like this.
Solid, he says. You know, old sport, I knew you had it in you, the cool.
I offer him $100 bill, my Vegas winnings. If you use a credit card in there, your whole fam-damily is gonna show up.
You think I'm an amateur?
He laughs and whips out a fake ID.
I'm Monty Baldwin, motherfucker. Get it? The Lost Baldwin brother? Fuck yeah.
And of course, that would be 40's dream in life, to be a Baldwin brother, surrounded by brothers instead of love.
This Baldwin will be back, he says.
He jogs toward the manager's office, his backpack bouncing. And I remember that first night at Chateau when I wondered if he and Walk Phoenix were buddies. I get out of the car and walk into the cemetery. The sun beats down on me and the dead people are nothing but bones under the dirt. The causes of death are listed: suicide, gunshot, plague. The cause of 40's death will be me, but it won't say that on his tombstone. And I wonder how many of these stories are true. There's a shovel against the side of the motel. I wish I could bury him here, but there are too many people around. Truck drivers, hippies with GoPro cameras, a family fighting over whether this is too much for the kids. I just need 40 to check in to talk with the manager. I read about the manager online, and he's the kind of guy that remembers everyone. He will remember Monty Baldwin. He will confirm that he seemed on something. Even if he says 40 was talking with someone in the parking lot, I am unrecognizable in my baggy clothes and my Colts jersey and rental car. I trudge back to the car, keeping my head down. I take out 5 Percocets. I smash them down and dump them into a bottle of water I bought at the gas station. As I shake, 40 emerges from the manager's office and returns to the car. Want to check out the hot springs? I suggest when he slips into his seat. I googled the springs when I was learning about the clown motel. It's true. You really can kill people in the desert.
They sound pretty crazy. Alkali, he says. Fuck yes, I have some ayahuasca, and oh, old sport, you haven't lived until you get in that water and you just see shit. This is what we were missing.
He belts up.
Just straight up road trip, riding all Kerouac, and what's the guy, the one with Johnny Depp, the one in Vegas with the backpack and the drugs and the sunglasses?
Jesus fucking Christ. Hunter S. Thompson. He claps.
Hunter S. Thompson.
Yeah, I say. And I can't get out of this parking lot fast enough. I hand him a bottle. Here, I say. We gotta hydrate before we trip. He tears off the cap. He didn't notice the broken seal. He gulps. "Old sport," he says. "I like the new you. Fuck all that shit in Hollywood and the family and the pressure and the nonsense. We're artists, man. My sister isn't. God bless her, but she's not, you know?" He turns on the music, my pitch-perfect pool mashup. He laughs at me and says my horrible taste in music is proof of my creative genius. "This is it," he says. "Freedom." I put the car in reverse. "Yeah," I manage. "Freedom." He unzips his backpack and takes out a butter knife and dips the soft-edged blade into a bag of blow. He sniffs, and this might be another Fincher occasion. I might not have to kill 40. At this rate, he'll do it himself. Chapter 44. The alkali springs are disgusting. Just two brown holes in the desert, like something you'd see in Little House on the Prairie or some Charles Manson documentary. It's disgusting in every way you can imagine. There's a fucking Magnum condom on the ground nearby, used, crusty. The wrapper is here too, along with a can of Bud. 40 swipes the can and sips, I might vomit. And he strips down and there's blood on his shirt. Somehow he managed to cut himself with his butter knife. And I turn away. I never wanted to see him naked, but I did want to see him here, alone, in the middle of nowhere, near Area 51. Nothingness filling the land for miles. He screams and pounds his chest as he steps into the water. "There it is!" he cheers. "Fucking springs, baby! Woo!" He drank the Percocet water on the way here, and not only is he still alive, but he talked the entire car ride here. He's not Henderson, and apparently it takes a pharmacy to kill a pharmaceutically enhanced person like 40. I hope I have enough. 40 settles in and someone else's ass was there and animals probably dip into this and people are foul. "Come on, Professor," he calls, waving. "I know you're all New York and shit, but there's nothing gay about getting into a spring with another dude." "I'm good." "Come on," he says. "This is God's hot tub. This is home, old sport. Get in here. Man up. Live up. Feel the fire. You get in here. This is how you make a movie. You let your mind go." He waves his arms at the blue blanket sky and howls. I sit down in the dirt. "You know," I say, "there are just as many creative people out there who aren't into this sort of thing. Woody Allen would never get into a dirty hole of hot water." 40 laughs. "He'd fuck a tween, though." He smiles. "He's an artist. We're weird. Professor, you need to get your weird on. Stop being so safe. You think you bear down, but do you ever just go for it? Honestly, you're a great writer, but I think you'd be golden if you had the guts to get in it." This coming from a guy who sold my scripts in his name, and I go back to the car to make him more Percocet water. Every time he does coke, he fights my downers. He's making this so much harder than it has to be, and we can't stay here forever. I shake the bottle and offer it to him. "I'm fine," he says, waving me off. "Get in." It's my turn to tell him I'm fine, and he attempts to swim in his little hole, as if there's room. It's fitting that he will drown in 2 feet of water when his sister appointed herself a national advocate for water safety. I sip my water. No drugs. "You sure you don't want some?" "Fuck, yes, I want a sip." His memory is eroding. I read about wet brain. Maybe that's what it is. 40 swallowing the water he said he didn't want a minute ago. I need him lower, weaker. Henderson had no tolerance. He went so quietly in the end, but this is ridiculous. "What else you got in your bag of tricks?" I ask.
"Ayahuasca, baby."
He reaches in for his tea. He drinks. That's a good boy. Let that tea mix with the Percocets. Let the poisons collide. He passes me the bottle. I pretend to drink. I am a good boy. In Closer, Jude Law tells Natalie Portman, this will hurt. And then it does hurt. This is where I am right now, no matter what a dick he is. It's starting to hit me. Killing 40 will hurt love. In a fucked up way, she won't know how to live without the drama, and this is going to be harder than I thought. But then, all change hurts. In the end, love will be a new person without her brother. She'll sleep better. She won't have to find a way to forgive him every time he fucks her over. She won't have to let him into her home or rationalize her feelings. Imagine what she could do with the power I'm giving to her by doing away with him. 40 flips onto his belly, a baby whale. He dips his butter knife into his bag. I feel whoa, he says. Like whoa. Just go with it, I tell him. Ride the wave. Wouldn't that be cool if there were waves in here? He asks. You ever think about that? How there can't be waves without a lot of water? This is the part of college I never wanted. A self-important fuckwit contemplating the sea. I get my phone. I can't listen to this shit. It's only gonna get worse as he slips away and loses access to his brain, what's left of it. I have a new email. A Google News alert. My chest tightens. I click on the link and it takes me to the Providence Journal Bulletin. There is a picture of Peach Salinger looking happier than she ever did in real life. Peach's parents love her more dead than they did when she was alive. They whitened her smile and enlarged her eyes, and now they are seeking justice. A wave, 40 pontificates. A wave never goes away. Like, what if the ocean just stopped? What then? 40 blathers. His words aren't words anymore, just sounds, as I read the news, the unbelievable news. The Little Compton Police Department received an anonymous tip regarding local girl and Brown graduate Peach Salinger. Authorities won't reveal details about the tip, but they do confirm that they have reopened the case. They were wrong that it was suicide, or at least they think they were wrong. The language is delicate, hesitant, but the message is clear. They think Peach Salinger was murdered, and they have started a brand new investigation. Oh, fuck. Double thousand triple fuckity fuck. 40 starts slapping the surface to create waves, and I have no patience for the whale in the water anymore. I have to get out of here. I have to deal with this. I put my phone in my pocket and I walk to the hole in the mud. He's half gone, pupils warbling toward the underside of his skull where that poisoned pink brain slows to a halt. He's going, but I can't wait. I can't sit here. Not with an investigation open on the other side of the country. Hey, buddy, I say. And when he swims toward me, I lean over and push 40 Quinn's head under the water. My hands are on fire. The water is at least 90 degrees and the air is hot and I feel my body become a furnace. The heat rises, curling around my arm like something out of a Dr. Seuss poem. He isn't like Henderson. He doesn't struggle. He is weak. Dark yellow piss whispers out of his soft, vile dick. Dehydration. I look up at the sky and I wait for his unconscious body to stop flailing. Finally, it's over. Monty Baldwin is dead. His fake ID is stuffed into his brick of coke. The condom wrapper is a godsend, more DNA, not mine. I pull my hands out of the water. I catch my breath. At some point, the butter knife fell into the water with him, and it's there, glistening at the bottom. I've never tried cocaine before. I dip my finger into his bag. I do like he did. One tiny bump. I shake. But maybe that's just that feeling you get when you're next to a brand new corpse. Chapter 45. There is no way around it. I have to lie to love. I am on the phone with her while I wait in the JetBlue terminal at McCarran Airport. They have slot machines here, too, and I am leaving Las Vegas, and I am going to Little Compton, but I can't tell Love that. I have no explicit plan. It's probably stupid of me to return to the scene of the crime, but I can't stay in Vegas and wait for the police to find 40, and I can't go to L.A. and sit on the sofa with Love and refresh the search engines for information on Peach Salinger. Because the truth is that I fucked up. I left the mug of urine, my one loose end, and I won't let it be my undoing. Besides, if I'm going to be caught for murdering that depressive, vicious Salinger, I'd rather it happen there. This is why dads don't let their kids visit them in prison. Why people dying from cancer don't want their picture taken. This investigation could expose that mug of piss, and I don't want Love to have to see me in handcuffs. Love is on the phone, silent, sighing every few seconds, a signal that she wants me to stay on. It is never a good thing when a woman is silent. I have to keep asking if she's there. Yes, she says. Why? Because you're not saying anything. What do you want me to say? She asks. I'm irritated. I'm sick of this. I can't get anything done, and I don't know if my brother's dead, and it sucks. I'm sorry, I say. I'm trying. Did you start at Caesar's, like I said? And I say yes, and we retrace my steps again, and I promise to keep trying. You know he'll turn up, I say. Which casino are you at right now? Planet Hollywood, I lie. She sighs. He doesn't like their tables. I know, I say. I remember you said that, love, but I'm trying everything, unless you want me to come home. No, she says. God, no, I'm sorry, I'm just tense. I know, it's okay, I say. I know she wants to stay on the phone and say nothing, but my flight to Providence, Rhode Island is boarding. You there?
Yes, Joe, stop asking me, are you there?
I'm here, I say. I'm not going anywhere. She cries. I tell her it's okay and now I'm gonna have to wait. I can't board with Group A. People are real assholes about their suitcases and I'm nervous there won't be room for mine, but Love comes first. Suddenly, she is laughing.
I'm watching Friends, she says. It's the one where...
Shit, I say. I think I see him. I hang up and rush to the jetway. It's a shitty thing to do, but watching Friends while you're on the phone with your boyfriend is also a shitty thing to do. I text her. Sorry, false alarm. I love you. She writes back,
XOXOXOX.
I wish she had said, I love you, but then again, I have to prepare myself for change. I go online again because I still can't believe it. I watch a press conference with Peach's parents, and her mother is identified as Florence Pinky Salinger. She is an old version of Peach, with fuller lips and broader shoulders.
I repeatedly told the police that while my daughter battled depression, she was not suicidal, she breathes. While it is comforting that the authorities are now treating my daughter's disappearance as a crime, a murder, it is deeply disconcerting that the police declined to investigate until someone called in an anonymous tip.
The woman heaves. The woman has no soul. No wonder Peach was so terrible.
It is a sad state of affairs when a mother's instinct and knowledge means nothing to a detective, but we are grateful that my daughter's murderer will at last be brought to justice.
She straightens her jacket, as if it matters what she looks like, and steps back from the podium. I wonder what it's like to be a mother, and you're going to give a speech for reporters about your dead daughter, and still you go and get your hair and makeup done? The broadcaster explains that the Salinger family intends to use all their resources to resolve this homicide case, and the video ends. We take off, and it's strange to be going back to Little Compton. To think of a time when I was so in love with Amy. I haven't thought about her or our trip in so long, about Noah and Pearl and Harry and Liam, about Charlotte and Charles and all that food and all that sex. I remember the way she tasted, and I remember the blueberry-stained sheets and the sound of her voice when she said she would try to learn to trust. If I never took Amy to Little Compton, would we still be together? Is life predestined, or do you change it by shoving your way into small, quaint towns because you're fascinated by how out of place you feel there? It's a risk, going back to Little Compton,
but I'm doing it for love. Our love can never be safe so long as the mug of urine is out there taunting me. And really, it's like love itself, like drinking. We all get our hearts broken. We get fucked up and throw up and we cry and listen to sad songs and say we're never doing that again. But to be alive is to do it again. To love is to risk everything. We land in Providence, and no flight was ever this fast. I text love. My phone died and I'm gonna crash. Nothing yet. Wish I had better news. Love you. She writes back immediately. Okay. I buy some crap in the airport. A candy bar that's too big, a copy of Mr. Mercedes, and a Red Sox cap. I walk directly to Budget Car Rental. There's no way to rent a car without showing an ID and providing a credit card. I do these things. What I have going for me? I was only here with Amy this summer, a vacationer. That guy who was here in the winter, that guy who smashed up his car and killed that girl, his name was Spencer Hewitt. I don't get a convertible. I get a Chevy. I start it up and I drive into my life, into my past, my future, my genetic coding, my mistakes, my possible salvation, my probable doom. Little fucking Compton. Chapter 46. The theme of my life appears to be working vacations. Like so many Americans, I appear to be incapable of taking a fucking break. And it's bad for you. This is where Europeans are healthier. They relax, they rest. They turn off their phones and leave their work in the office, and when they go to the beach, they take off their tops. They show their tits and their hairy chests, and they drink and sunbathe and they fucking go for it. I, on the other hand, am one of those fucked up workaholic Americans plodding on an empty beach, not savoring the sunset, not romping in the waves, though it's too cold, it's autumn. And I am working hard, deciding how the hell am I gonna get into that motherfucking house. After I checked into my shitty motel, I went into a sleep coma. Vegas will fuck you up. I think I went 28 hours without so much as a nap. I woke up on the cruddy, low-thread-count bedspread in a pile of my own drool. I showered in the stifling tiny shower, and I used the terrible small rectangles of bad soap, and I drove to the public parking lot that's closest to the beach near the Salinger house. And I started walking. As if you can just walk into a fucking crime scene. Before I even got there, I saw the activity, the police cruisers and the TV news vans, the various Salingers in their winter clothes, and I had to back off. I pretend to be a guy walking on a beach relaxing, and meanwhile, that fucking house fills up with people who might find my mug of piss. I need to get in there, so I try to get in there. I drive to Crowther's and order a shit ton of food to go. I buy one of their t-shirts. I go to the Salinger house and park as close as I can. The TV vans are gone, news is only news for a little while, and there is only one cop. I put on my Red Sox cap and I lift the heaving box of food and I trot toward the house, the way any delivery guy would. I knock on the door, the way any delivery guy would. Nobody answers, so I ring the bell, the way any delivery guy would. A guy who can't be more than 20 and looks exactly like Peach walks up. He's wearing a Yale t-shirt and scratching his head. He looks like he's never held a rake or scratched a lottery ticket in a 7-Eleven. "What's up?" he asks. "I have a delivery," I say, as if this isn't completely fucking obvious. "Can I get in there and put this down?" The Salinger's eyes roll to the side of his oval head. "Mom!" he calls out. "Buddy," I say, "my back's breaking here. If I could get in there and get this down." But now his mother is here. "Trot," she says, "don't scream." She looks at me. "I'm sorry," she says. "We're requesting that all flowers and food and gifts be sent to the battered women's shelter in Fall River. Peach was very passionate about women's rights, and we just don't need the food." Peach was not very passionate about women's rights. She was passionate about women's pussies.
She wanted to fuck back, which is why I killed her. Salingers. This bitch just stares at me.
Do you speak English? She asks.
No, but I speak cunt.
That's so great of you, I say. But my boss would have my ass if I drove to Fall River. You sure I can't just get in there and leave this with you?
Meaning get in there and steal the keys that are undoubtedly on the kitchen table because rich people, particularly the ones on the East Coast, really like to throw their shit on the kitchen table? The bitch sighs.
You poor thing.
She reaches for her purse. She thinks I want a tip.
You take this and you keep that food.
She slips me a $5 bill and gives me a fake smile. The kind people do when they want you to know they're faking it. She closes the door and locks it, and now I've been made by not one but two fucking Salingers, so it's not like I can show up here tomorrow in a UPS uniform. Not that I have a UPS uniform. All I have is a heaving box of food. I drive to my shitty motel room. I eat. I text love. Still nothing, and yes, I am the asshole who got sucked into a blackjack table for hours. She writes back,
I'm not your parole officer. You don't have to report to me. I know you're working hard. I'm helping my dad with some pantry stuff.
This was the wrong time for her to use the phrase parole officer, and I don't want to talk to her until I've destroyed that mug of piss. I wish I could change things. I wish I had taken care of this mug before we met.
Miss you, she writes,
and most girls would throw hissy fits if their boyfriends went into silent mode in Las fucking Vegas for several hours, especially while said girl was in the middle of a family crisis. My phone buzzes, and now she's calling me.
I just wanted to hear your voice, she says when I answer.
How you doing? I ask her. She starts in about a difficult woman at work, Sam, and I yawn, and the room is cold, and I walk to the window to close the blinds, and I left my headlights on. Fuck, I say.
What's wrong? She asks. Are you okay?
Yeah, I say. I left my lights on, it's fine. I grab the keys and go outside, the bitter cold, and I turn off the lights and I run back inside, and love asks me where I am. A diner, I say. The Peppermill. She said she's glad I'm eating and she wants me to rest. She says I sound tense. I tell her I sound tense because I am tense. She tells me that when they were in college, 40 disappeared for 2 months.
Right after I got married, she says. 2 months, Joe. You know you can't stay in Vegas for 2 months.
I won't. But I can't give up yet, I say.
Promise me you'll take care of yourself, she says.
I promise her. And then I make shitty motel coffee and go on Tinder. Fortunately, there aren't that many girls in the area. I swipe and I swipe and I swipe. I swipe while I piss and I swipe in the bed and I swipe in the car and then I find her. Jessica Salinger. I recognize her from a picture of the family in the article. She's a prettier version of Peach and she's less than a mile away. This is what I needed to know, that she was still here. Her fucking Facebook and Twitter are private, but her pussy, apparently, is open. Humans. I will never understand. I shower. I shave. I dress. I run out to my car and thank God I noticed the lights because my battery works and I need it to work. I need to get to Scuppers now, the place I went with Supercunt. It's the only joint in town, really, this time of year. And I go in, and the first thing I notice are the tall chairs at the bar, brown as opposed to the white leather chairs at the Bellagio. And two chairs are of particular interest to me because one contains Jessica Salinger. The other has the friend I was banking on. And there is plenty of room for me at the bar. It's quiet, some fucking Sade in the background. Really, Rhode Island? And I have no competition. There are two other dudes here, construction workers, I think. They're both wearing rings, more interested in the news than the girls. There's no band to get in the way of things and tease the young girls. There's no crowd, not even with all the excitement involving the dead girl. New Englanders are stingy and they hibernate at night as if going out makes you into some kind of whore.
Of course, I'm not going to go for Jessica Salinger. That would be too creepy, since I was just at their house today. I have to put the moves on the friend, the one I knew she'd be out with. Because girls like Jessica always have a friend around. And she's always a little shorter, a little more drunk, a little more down to earth. Literally. This friend is tapping her straw and removing it from her cocktail. This friend is bored. This friend is gonna be mine. Easy. It's been so long since I hit on a girl in a bar, but I know how it works. All you do is stare into the girl's face, reflected in the mirror ahead. You let her friend notice you staring. You don't look away. She meets your gaze in the mirror and you crack up and you apologize. It's so good to start with sorry. And you tell her that you didn't mean to stare, but you couldn't help it. You're just so gorgeous, I say. And I don't mean that in a creepy douche kind of way, and I'm not going to try and pick you up when I see you're very clearly here with your friend. And then I take all my marbles away and flag the bartender and order a gimlet. I want to know why Forty was so into them. And now the girl puts her hand on my arm. What's your name? Brian, I say, like Brian from Cabo. Brian Stanley. Well, she says, I'm Dana, and this is my girlfriend, Jessica. Are you here by yourself? Yeah, I say. What about you girls? Are you here by yourselves? Jessica rolls her eyes, and this is exactly what I want. My gimlet comes. I sip. I ask Dana what she's doing here, and she tells me she's here to provide moral support for her friend, Jessica. Jessica is feeling more invisible by the second. It won't be long now. And I sip my gimlet slowly. Dana is Jessica's roommate in New York, and Dana is a first-year law student, and Dana loves this cute little town, and Dana loves this song, and she loves this bar, and Jessica does not love being a third wheel. She stands. Do you guys mind if I get out of here? I apologize. I am Mr. Manners. And Dana says she should go, and Jessica says that's ridiculous. She says she's tired. Dana doesn't know how she'll get home. It's not like New York where you can just call a cab, she says. No, I should go. Jessica says she'll be in the car. Jessica Salinger has no use for me. I tell Dana it's unorthodox and presumptuous, but I could give her a lift home if she wanted to stay. Thank you, she says. But I don't even know you. Yeah, I say. I'm sorry, I wasn't trying to. 2 hours later, Dana is a teetering drunk girl and she's in good hands with me. I help her out of the bar. I open the car door for her.
Just like say anything, she says.
I start the car. This is it. I'll have to keep up the gentleman act and escort her into the Salinger house. And she's so drunk, she won't be able to make it up the stairs alone. So, I say, where am I taking you?
Ugh, she says. Hang on, I have to find the address on my phone.
I almost fuck up and tell her I already know the address, but she unlocks her phone, 1267, and she bites her lip and she scrolls through her email.
Got it, she says. 32 Starboard Way.
My head snaps up. That's not Peach's address. Are you sure? She raises her phone and shows me the Airbnb page and I am fucked. A whole night wasted.
I usually stay with Jess and her family, she says, but they have some crazy shit going on right now. Did you see the news about the girl who they think was killed here? That was her cousin.
Really? I say. And I look both ways and I use my blinker and I curse Tinder. That's some scary shit. When I escort Dana into her Airbnb, she tries to kiss me. I tell her I'm sorry. I'm getting over someone, I say. I'm really sorry. I just can't now, you know? Dana gets it. She says she's been there. But she has no fucking idea. I go back to my shitty motel. I should have gotten an Airbnb. Chapter 47. I go down to breakfast the next morning, and why in the fuck would I ever want to make my own waffles? Do I look Belgian?
I itch, and I think my room has bed bugs. And the number one thing I did not miss about the East Coast, the humidity. After the brisk chill of yesterday, Little Compton, Rhode Island is suddenly in the midst of an unplanned natural event they call Indian Summer. The girl at the front desk beams, sunburnt, small-minded.
Did you come here for the Indian Summer? It's a wicked pisser.
I came here to get my mug of urine, thank you very much. And my hole in the wall is a fetid hot zone of bacteria. I know it, and this morning when I showered, I felt like I wasn't alone. I feel very cramped in here, as if my civil liberties have been chopped up by the bitch at the front desk, by the 11-year-old kid who cut in front of me in the waffle line. I am nervous. The kid's fat dad whistles. I think you're beeping. I yank the top of the waffle iron and my waffle is blackened and there is a long line. It would be a dick move to make another. I remove my raw on the inside, black on the outside freebie carb from the old machine and stick it onto a plate that is sticky that clearly didn't make it into the dishwasher. There are kids everywhere. Talk of water parks and a drive-in an hour out, and isn't it October? What are all these people doing here? I didn't anticipate the crowds, the talk of blueberry syrup and gas prices, the New England of it all. The coffee is weak, no shit, Sherlock, I know. And the dad plops a waffle onto my plate. You look like you could use a lift, he says, and he winks. And it is a kind world, a fair world. I need my energy. I eat the waffle and I drink the coffee and then I do a drive-by at Peach's house. It's more crowded today than it was yesterday, and I can't go anywhere near it now that I fucked up with my special delivery, and Jessica Salinger thinks my name is Brian. Is someone finding that mug of piss right now? I get out of the car. A couple of old ladies are power walking. The skinny one.
And you know, apparently she was a lezzie.
The skinnier one.
Do they think that awful mother of hers might have killed her? You know, I wouldn't put it past her.
The skinny one.
She's putting on weight.
The skinnier one.
She shouldn't be going around in those flats. She needs lift.
At least Peach didn't come from one of those happy families where nobody can conceive of anyone in the family committing a crime. New Englanders like murder as much as they enjoy the music of Taylor Swift and the antics of the Kennedys. I want to hear more parking lot banter, so I go to town where it's more crowded. I enter the art cafe and gallery, and immediately I know this was a mistake. Heads turn. Elderly locals bemoan the nosy New Yorkers sniffing around and look me up and down. Were it not for my California tan, I'd probably be strung up on the flagpole outside, but fortunately, there is a distraction. A flock of grown men in spandex enter, cyclists. And they are regulars here, and they are welcome, and I am invisible again. I purchase a coffee. I wrestle with the bad pump on the milk dispenser, and a cyclist advises me to hit it once, hard. It works. My luck is turning. Thanks, I say. I look at him, and my luck is turning back again. The way every session at a blackjack table eventually concludes with the dealer making 21. Luke Skywalker knows that he might die in battle, and Eminem knows that he might get too choked up to make rhymes, and I, Joe Goldberg, know that when I fly to Rhode Island and re-enter my bad place, Little Fucking Compton, it is possible that I might wander into a store, let my guard down, and find myself face to face with the cop I met on my first visit. Yes. It's Officer Nico, in purple spandex and a blue helmet. Already his eyes are narrowing.
I know you, he says. And he does. He knows me as Spencer Hewitt, the boy he found in the boathouse next to the Salingers after he crashed his car. He knows my Fagawi hat. He's going to remember me, and he's going to remember that cold December night. He might even read the file on Peach Salinger and realize that she disappeared right around the same time as that Hewitt kid was freezing in that boathouse. I take a step backward. Thanks for the milk. I owe you one. He is unperturbed. I never forget a face, he says. Hold on. The other cyclists need milk too, and he motions for me to follow him outside. Indian Summer. And even off-duty, he has the authority of an officer of the law.
He is the reason that Robin Fincher never should have made it through Police Academy, and he is biting his lip and taking the lid off his coffee. "Do you live around here?" he asks. "No," I say. "I'm just up from Boston." He is as kind as I remember, and I wonder if he ever fucked that nurse in the hospital in Fall River who seemed so into him. The other cyclists are trickling out onto the lawn, and they are dullards mostly, white dentists. They want their black cop buddy back. I raise my hand to make my escape, and raising my hand sparks Officer Nico's memory, and that's right, this is New England, where people watch because they like to watch, where memories are intact, primed because the people here are not bogged down by aspirations. The only thing Nico aspires to do is save the fucking world, and he snaps his fingers. "The Buick," he says. "You were that kid. Poor kid, you totaled that Buick." The cyclists are interested now, and I'm a part of this world in the worst possible way. If I lie, if I say that wasn't me, Nico will know it. He's a real cop. "That's you?" I say, and I put my coffee down and move to shake his hand. "You saved my life." Never mind the absurdity of me, a white guy who passed through the whitest place in America in the dead of white winter, not remembering the very black officer who found me in a boathouse and drove me to a hospital. I am fucked. Or maybe not. Nico shakes my hand, solid. "I'm surprised you remember any of it," he says. "You were banged up." "I remember the important parts," I assure him. "I didn't recognize you with your gear on. You guys all ride on the reg?" Now I have included the dentists, provided them with the chance to tell an outsider about their weekly rides with their cop friend, their banal adventures, the dings with bad drivers, the roadkill, the time that Barry rode over that hose and fell and everyone is belly laughing. Oh, Barry. Officer Nico is relaxed, involved in a few conversations, none about me. I am okay. I pulled it off. I will stay a while just to prove that I am at ease. And when one guy asks what brings me to their sunny seaside hamlet, I don't hesitate. "Indian summer," I say, and I call upon the amiable demeanor of Harvey Swallows. I open my arms. Am I right or am I right? I am right, and soon it's time for the cyclists to move on. Nico waves goodbye. He hopes my stay this time around doesn't involve a trip to the emergency room. I knock on the table. He squints. "Son," he says, "that's a metal table." He laughs and he goes, and I find a birch tree. I knock. I am still itchy. It could be psychosomatic, but it could be real. I might have picked something up from Dana. God knows what germs were crawling on me in Vegas, on the plane. I am uncomfortable in my skin in Little Compton. I never should have gone to the art cafe, and I never should have come here. I strip the bed. I search for bed bugs, and I don't find any. I flip the mattress, but there is nothing wrong with the mattress. There is something wrong with me. Love lifts us up, but it also makes us roam around Little Compton like we didn't murder the girl in the news. I'm hungry. The motel doesn't offer a continental dinner, and I am starving and marooned here, unable to will myself out the door for a Burger King run, too itchy to sleep, too potentially fucked to attempt to relax. If I can't get that mug of urine, then the police will get that mug of urine. If the police run tests on that mug and connect the dots, I will go to prison and I won't be able to get back to California and marry Love. I stop itching. I didn't realize that until now. I want to marry her, I say. And suddenly I know what I'm doing here. I'm being that person who runs away from love, the one who self-sabotages. I don't think I can sleep in this room, in this township, in this universe, and I drag the sheets into the bathroom, the only sterile vortex in this musty pit. I rankle at the sadness of it all, the granite countertops and the shiny little soaps, the non-organic shampoos. Love wouldn't want any of this, and all I want is her. I dump the sheets in the tub, and I wash my hands, and I hear a knock at the door. My heart races, but the rest of my body freezes, and I picture Officer Nico's face. I panic. There is another knock. It feels like the end. On the way to the door, I trip. I bump my knee against the bed. My body is protesting. I reach for the handle. Steeling myself, I swing the door open. But the person standing there isn't Officer Nico. It's someone worse. Love. Chapter 48. Love's arms are folded across her chest.
You said you left your lights on, she says, but it was only 5.
Love, I say, I can explain.
I hope so, she says, because you should also know that Pitch Perfect is not and never was on Netflix.
She enters my room. Anyone here? She asks. No, I say, I'm alone. She looks at the stripped bed.
What's this all about? Destroying the evidence?
No, I say, and I can't keep up with her questions. Love, let me explain. She raises her voice.
Yoo-hoo! You can come out now!
Love, I say, there's nobody here.
You know, we all live in the world, Joe. You think I can't figure out that you flew to Rhode Island and rented a car? And I don't mean this in the asshole way, but you know who my father is. His people couldn't find 40 because 40 knows how to hide. Because we grew up in this, and we know how to disable our phones and pay with cash, but you think I can't find you? Jesus Christ, where is she? Hello?
Love, please stop.
No, she says.
She is wearing a navy raincoat, bell-bottom blue jeans, and a shrunken pink sweater. I want to hug every part of her, even now, while she accuses me of cheating on her, especially now. She isn't going anywhere. She isn't afraid of me, even though she knows I was lying, even though I disappeared on her while I said I was looking for her brother. She isn't the police, she is love, which is why she is crying.
Why won't you tell me things?
She says.
I tell you things, but you shut down, you won't tell me the real deal. Why don't you tell me how you saw Pitch Perfect? Because no, Joe, you didn't see it randomly on Netflix. It's not on Netflix, and even if it was, a lie just feels different. I know you know that, and I think about this shit, you know, in the middle of the night, when you're asleep. This is the kind of shit I think about. Why won't you tell me?
Love, I say, and I can't explain it, but I want to tell her. I want her to know.
You know, she says. When you do stuff on your phone, I mean since the very beginning, like the whole time we've been together, I know you are doing something. Sometimes I think you have cancer. I actually console myself by thinking he just has some disease and he's going to die and he doesn't know how to tell me that I'm going to get my heart broken.
I don't have cancer, I assure her. But then I do. I have the mug of urine. It is a tumor, spreading, malignant, infiltrating my love. My love. She's still wearing her coat.
I know you don't have cancer, Joe. That's the point. But I have to know what you have. I can't take it anymore. I have enough problems. I have a brother who disappears, and a father who can't even pretend he wants him to come back, and a mother who wishes he wasn't here in the first place. I can't do this.
She is crying. I go to her, but she doesn't want me.
No, she says. You can't be in this with me if you won't be in this with me.
She wipes her eyes.
What the fuck are you even doing here? Why are you in Rhode Island? Is my brother here? Who are you? Because I can't fucking ask you anymore. I can't ask you anymore.
I'm sorry. She's right. You can't be in love, not fully, not eternally, if you can't tell the truth. It builds up on you. She told me about fucking Milo in the chateau.
But how can I tell her my truth?
I killed her brother. It's like the atomic version of that universal truth. You can talk shit about your mother, but nobody else can, no matter what you say, no matter what she does. I can't tell love what I've been up to, and to talk to her is to lie to her.
I should just go. I don't know what I'm doing here.
I kneel at her feet. Please stay.
Why?
Because I love you. She shakes her little head.
Love isn't enough, Joe. It isn't nearly enough. I want more.
I know you do.
I don't know what else to say, she says.
but I can't stand the way you make me feel so good, like better than I ever felt, and then you tear it all away, like deep down, you don't want me to be happy.
Of course I want you to be happy.
Then tell me who you are. Tell me why you said you watched Pitch Perfect on Netflix.
Love, I say, and if we were married, if I had let her go with me to Vegas and we had eloped, she would not be able to testify against me in a court of law. But we are not married, and the justice system does not acknowledge relationships like ours. I want to marry this girl. I want to stay with this girl. I want our ashes mixed, our crumbling bodies buried side by side. I want her to know how badly I want that. I don't want to live without her. I don't want to let go of her. If she leaves me, what then?
So that's all you have to say. That's fine. Fine.
She sounds cold and she is inching away from me.
Joe, she says, it's over.
I look up at her. This is like Homeland when he's going to cut a wire and the bomb might explode. I might kill us, everything we have, but maybe I can live with that because without her I will die, I know it. I accept that she might hit me, call me names, run to the cops. This could be the end, but this could also be the beginning. When you get baptized, you fall back into the water, your entire body. Some people hold their noses, some people don't. But there is no way around it. You have to get wet if you want to be in God's hands. I take love's hands. I choose love. I accept risk. I breathe. I speak. The first time I saw Pitch Perfect was when I broke into a girl's apartment. When I am done, when I have told her everything, everything but 40, of course, she just sits there. The minutes tick by and her face gives me nothing. The way Matt Damon's face never looks all that fucked up when he's being Jason Bourne. I think about what I've done, about how it all must seem to her. I did not do that thing where you leave out the grotesque details to make yourself seem like some kind of unstained, impervious hero. I told her how I stole Beck's phone and strangled Peach on the beach. I told her about the blood of the Da Vinci Code in Beck's mouth when she slipped away, how I buried her upstate. I told her about the mug of piss. I gave her as much as I had, but it's like the difference between a movie and a book. A book lets you choose how much of the blood you want to see. A book gives you the permission to see the story as you want, as your mind directs. You interpret. Your Alexander Portnoy doesn't look like mine because we all have our own unique view. When you finish a movie, you leave the theater with your friend and talk about the movie right away. When you finish a book, you think. Love grew up on movies, and I have just read her a book. I give her the time to digest. I am preparing for the worst, for Love's face to change, for her to run out of here screaming. In a funny way, all the women in my life helped me brace for this moment. My mother, Beck, Amy. Women leave me, and Love will leave me. She has to. She believes in love and decorates her home with it, carries it on her passport, in her heart. She's gonna walk out of this room and feel like she's done it again, chosen the wrong man, blown those other two out of the saltwater infinity pool, will never go in again. I've never opened up like this, never said it all out loud before, and I hold my knees to my chest and tell myself that what happens next is out of my control. I can't make love love me, but I did the right thing. I told her what she wanted to know. I stopped lying. The wait is eternal. And her eyes are fixed on a stain on the floor. I think of all the people who stayed in this room before and wonder if any of them have been like me. And then finally, she looks up.
Okay, she says. I'm going to tell you about Roosevelt.
Roosevelt was a puppy they had when they were babies. 40 named him. She didn't know why then, doesn't know why now.
He's weird that way, she says, as if he's still alive. I mean, what 6-year-old calls a puppy Roosevelt? And also, it's not like he was precocious and into politics or whatever. He just liked the word Roosevelt.
It's a good name, I say. She ignores me.
Anyway, she says, Roosevelt disappeared. And we looked everywhere and put up signs and all that.
But then Forty woke me up in the middle of the night, and he took me outside and showed me that Roosevelt wasn't missing. He was dead.
Oh, dear. She looks at me. She holds my hands. Now she is the one who's not blinking, staring at me directly.
He tied Roosevelt to the wall, she says. He was mad at him because he kept wanting to sleep in my room instead of Forty's. So he punished him. He starved him and muzzled him.
Love, I say. I've never harmed an animal. I can't imagine being that sort of monster. Jesus Christ. She takes her hands away.
You have no idea what it is to be twinned with someone who does things like that.
Her voice quavers when she says things like that, and Roosevelt is not alone. There are other crimes, I'm sure. Love, I say. I'm so sorry.
So it's like this, she says. I love that fucking sicko. I know he is demented, and I know he tied a dog to a wall, but you know what? I didn't tell anyone. And you know what else? Fuck that dog for ignoring him. Fuck that Monica for bailing on him for that loser friend of yours, and fuck all the girls who act like there's something defective about him, who don't even pretend they want his money. Fuck my parents for not even pretending to think he's talented, and fuck Milo for being better at everything. Fuck everyone who's like, who was born first, you or 40, and fuck people who are never surprised when I'm like, I was born first, because they're like, of course you were, you seem so together. Fuck everyone, Joe. I mean, I will defend my fucked up brother all day long because life isn't fair. It isn't. Roosevelt cried when Forty tried to hold him. And Forty was the one who wanted Roosevelt in the first place. Who makes a world like that? Where you can't hate anyone because ultimately everyone has some god-awful fucking thing they put up with, and you have no way of knowing what it is exactly. I mean, he's gotta be 40, but I've gotta be his fucking sister. Who has it worse?
She shakes her head.
Tell me, who has the right to hate anyone?
Love is breathing heavily. It's clear she's never talked about this to anyone. You know when someone is opening up a box so private that there isn't a key. She looks at me.
All I know is how to love, she says. So I can deal with you.
Ouch. She takes my hand.
That's a compliment,
she assures me.
This is why I hate it when people keep getting married like it's so simple. It's not. Finding someone who gets you is special.
I kiss the back of her hand. What kind of dog was it?
Golden, she says. Roosevelt was a golden.
I love you, love.
I love you, she says.
I flinch when a car breaks outside, the screech. I'm still nervous, still can't quite believe it. She smiles.
Look, Joe, I wouldn't have come here if I didn't know that it might be bad.
Bad, I repeat. She squeezes my hand.
This is it for me. In this messed up way, I feel like this will work. You did all those awful things, but you also fell in love with a person who can forgive you.
I don't know what to say. I say, and I think of 6-year-old love staring at that dead puppy.
Joe,
she says, and my name belongs to her now. There's more. She says she knew when Trey died that if she ever found anyone again, it would be forever. And she looks at the floor, and then she looks at me.
I'm pregnant.
Did I hear that right? Pregnant? Yes, I heard that right.
Pregnant.
Now there is permanence between us, and it means her forgiveness is whole, true. If she were afraid of me on any level, she would have run out of this room and never told me about the baby, our baby. And then it hits me. We're gonna have a baby. We're laughing and I'm kissing her belly, and she's telling me about taking the test, it's early, and she had to come tell me in person and she's glad she did. Me too, I say. This baby is a great equalizing force between us, the definition of the future. No matter what I did, a part of me is inside of love. It's the most beautiful thing in the world, and love and I are fixed, locked together,
our genes intertwining, a little human, part me, part her, wholly triumphant. Watching love doze off, I feel love like I never have before.
Sweet dreams, I say, and I kiss the place between love's slumbering breasts.